epautos.com. Always a pleasure to have epautos.com. Always a pleasure to have Eric on. We got a lot of stuff to talk about. There's been a lot of interesting news coming out lately. How are you doing, Eric?
Well, I'm feeling so very safe because apparently the pandemic is officially over today.
That's right. Yeah. It's over, but the emergency martial law continues, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, actually, speaking of that, the national terrorism emergency that was declared almost 22 years ago after 9/11, Biden just reauthorized that again.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They leave all that stuff in there. I've been talking about it. I said, you know, it's interesting to me that everybody is saying, well, the pandemic is over because he said it's over. Well, you know, Trump said it was over October 28th, just before that election. He said he had saved everybody. They had to walk that back a little bit, but it was a week before the election he said it, but he didn't take the order off. And so even though Biden will say it, he still has given himself the legal authority, and it's based on what the emergency order that Trump put in 922 days ago. And that's what he even based this new entitlement program that he created out of thin air by a dictate, you know, the student loan thing. That's an entitlement program he created by executive order because of that thing. These things, there's been 60 emergency executive orders since they put in the National Emergencies Act in 1976, and half of those are still there, and they keep re-upping it. It's absolutely amazing.
Well, fundamentally, these people are magicians in that they can conjure an emergency just by saying so. And we're all supposed to fall in line and say, yep, there's an emergency. And we're supposed to pretend, just like the emperor's followers, that the emperor's new clothes look fabulous.
That's right. And the Republicans will not talk about the fact that this is based on Trump's order because they don't want to get that taken off. It's amazing to me that they just completely ignore that. They never even talked about the fact of the student loan entitlement thing being based on that until this happened with 60 Minutes. And now they still don't say, well, we got to get rid of that. You know, they need to at least start a campaign to do that. Some of them ought to offer articles of impeachment, even though they wouldn't pass. They need to offer that to impeach him for continuing an emergency fraudulently when he doesn't believe it. But the real issue really goes back to the 1976 law, because if they leave that thing in, Biden could bootstrap himself into this medical martial law just by declaring an emergency and then waiting a while and then doing whatever he wants based on that self-declaration. That's the way this whole thing works. It's absurd.
Sure. And also for his putative successor, whoever that might be.
That's right.
I think fundamentally, you know, whenever they tell us that we need to be afraid and so obey, we need to ask, well, why should we be afraid? And dig into it and look into the facts and determine whether there's a reason to be afraid. And if there isn't a reason to be afraid, we should be angry at people who tell us to constantly live in fear and obey.
Well, I've been angry for quite a while. I get angry every time I get into this stuff. I knew you have as well. And so, you know, there's different MacGuffins out there, different things that they want to tell us to motivate us. You got an article about decarbonization. Talk about that. How are we going to get rid of all organic material here?
Well, we don't exactly know just yet. What we do know is that at least four agencies and departments of the federal apparatus, including the Department of Energy, the EPA, and a couple of others, interestingly, the Housing and Urban Development, too, is in on this, are coming up with a plan. They always come up with plans, don't they, to decarbonize the transportation sector. And, you know, essentially what that means is that they're going to try to force everybody into this unitary, centralized, electrified future where no matter what you have that's powered, it will be powered by electricity if they deign to allow you to have the electricity to power it.
That's right. Yeah. And now, like I said, they've always got plans, and, you know, they got plans about this. They got plans about central bank digital currency. I mean, they've got, that's the scary thing about this. You know, go ahead.
The interesting thing about their plans is that they always involve force. They're never suggestions. They're never, let's take this into consideration and see whether it makes sense. So whenever you hear the word plan, you can rest assured that it's of a piece with the government asking you to do something, which means they're going to force you to do something.
That's right. Yeah, I was just reading a couple of guys who've been pushing back against the vaccine, but now they're easing up. And they said, you know, when we look back on this, was this a sinister plan? Or was this just bad science and rushing this stuff out? It's like, it was a sinister plan, and we got more sinister plans on the way. You know, we got sinister plans for CBDC. We got sinister plans to destroy transportation in the name of decarbonization. They are loaded to the gill with sinister plans. It's amazing.
No question. Yeah. And I think what's being planned right now, we'll have to wait a little while to see what actually fleshes out. But I think that the plan is going to involve not just pushing electric cars, I call them EVs to mock them a little bit, onto us, but also to push us out of anything that isn't an EV. They're going to do things, I suspect, such as impose polluter pays types of taxes on people who continue to cling to non-electric cars, increase registration fees, all sorts of things short of an actual outright ban. That's their trick. You know, they figured out that it's much more palatable to most people to just make things more expensive, harder to use, rather than outright ban them, because for whatever reason, people won't push back against that.
That's right. Yeah, I love the way you write. And let me just read a quote here from your decarbonization article. You say, decarbonization is neutral, a neutral voice to hide the fact that what is being planned is to be forced. And it will result in modernized transportation sector where we're not going to have any transportation. You say Jennifer Granholm, whose secretariat is the energy equivalent to the Ministry of Peace, is that it concerns itself with winnowing the supply of energy. Here she is, energy secretary, and her purpose is to destroy energy, just like the purpose of the Ministry of Peace was to destroy peace.
That's right. Yeah. What the object is here is to eliminate personal mobility in favor of government transportation. In other words, you'll be beholden to the government for your opportunity to go anywhere that they say you can. You'll have to beg permission. You'll have to wait on their schedule. And if you do something that they don't like, then they'll simply deny you access to transportation. What they do not want is for ordinary proletarians like you and I to have access to a privately owned vehicle that's under our own control that we can use to go wherever we like and to live and work wherever we like.
That's right. Yeah, it was just this week that we saw Buttigieg and Whitmer talking about how they were going to spend $100 million to destroy a racist interstate overpass. And this was put in so that you didn't have a massive amount of traffic going through a neighborhood. They would prefer to have a massive amount of traffic going through the neighborhood. They said it's divisive. It's like, yeah, okay. They don't even want to have roads. They don't want to have anything as an input into the power grid. And this is already happening as they're rolling this stuff out. It is already collapsing on the input side, as we see in California, where they said, don't charge your cars. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we don't even have to wait to see how this is going to end.
Yeah, and another thing, too, that speaks to motives, and I think you and I have touched on this before. I know I've written about it before. It speaks to intentions. You know, some people will think, well, you know, they're just trying to do this because it's a beneficial thing. We have to do this because of this climate change stuff. And then I respond to them, well, if that's the case, then why aren't they doing anything to increase the generating capacity to take up the demand that they are going to impose on it, on the grid? You know, it doesn't make sense unless, of course, the object is to ration both mobility and energy.
That's right. Oh, yeah, absolutely it is. Now, let's talk about something that is positive here, because I really couldn't believe it when I saw this article about the new Ford Mustang. I kind of figured that it was done since they'd come out with a Mustang-badged EV that was kind of an SUV or something, a crossover or something.
The Mach-E.
Yeah, it kind of mocks the mock. They should spell that M-O-C-K.
that's hilarious. I love that.
A Mach-tane is what they should call it. It's not a Mustang, it's a Mach-tane. But this is a real Mustang. This is a bona fide V8 with a stick shift, and it's the most power they've had on one of these things.
Yes.
That's kind of
well, and the beautiful thing about it, the very smart thing that I think they've done is to capture the market, because Dodge has already said that they are going to cancel the V8 version of the Charger and the Challenger after next year, so that's gone.
That's right.
Looks like that General Motors is going to pull the plug on the Camaro after the 2025 model year, maybe even before then. So that will leave the Mustang as the last type of that car that's still available for people who want to buy it. And because it's a next-gen car, it's going to be around for at least the next 5 or 6 years, you know, long enough, hopefully, to get us through this horribleness that's being imposed on us. And maybe as a society, we'll recover our senses, and other car companies will come up and be able to build Chargers and Camaros again at some point in the future.
Well, you know, it looks like the Ford CEO is kind of savvy. His name's Jim Farley. He said, we don't see any hybrid applications even coming up for this vehicle. He goes, this is about the V8 experience. And you know, one of the things that he's got, which I thought was hilarious, was on your key fob, you can actually rev the engine while you're standing outside the car, because, you know, you want to hear that nice exhaust note that's coming out of that Ford Mustang V8.
Yeah, that's an interesting counterpoint to what poor Steve Kaniskis, who's the head of Dodge, had to do a couple of weeks ago when he brought out that electric Charger, and you heard the fake sound coming out of the amplifier system. And he knows better. You know, he's a car guy. He understands what's going on. But the bottom line is it's not his call. You know, Dodge at this point is just an auxiliary or a subsidiary of this gigantic combine called Stellantis that owns a number of brands. And they've dictated to Dodge what Dodge is going to be permitted to build. So he's trying to do his best to put lipstick on a pig. And I feel bad for the guy.
Yeah.
Because I know he knows it's bogus and junk.
Mm-hmm.
And good on Ford for, you know, not bowing to the pressure on this and continuing to produce that type of car. And for understanding that people who buy those kinds of cars don't want to hear sound amplifying coming out of an electric blender somewhere. They want to hear the V8.
I thought that was so funny when I first saw that. I was like, what is God? How did they get that revving thing? And I was like, did they put that over the soundtrack thing? And then I find out they've got the onboard sound generator speakers and stuff like that to make it sound like a muscle car. It was hilarious. Well, you know,
I mean, I can't think of anything more pathetic than that. I mean, it's like holographic 3D sex.
It was. Yeah, it really was pathetic. Yeah, so the CEO of Ford says that's why he came to the company. He said, Mustang is one of the reasons I came to the company, because the company was committed to making vehicles that are opinionated, he said.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I thought that was good news. So maybe, you know, it's a, like you said, it's a smart move. They're going to have the market cornered. Their competition is shutting down everywhere. He says, they're not the result of extensive consumer research. They exist because of our belief that cars are still an emotional product that can give you an experience other products can't. But it really is about customer demand, right?
The other ones are
the ones that they're pushing on people. This is not what they're pushing on people. This is what people want. It's the other ones that they're saying, no, you will have this other thing.
Yeah, when everybody's making the same thing, the smart move is to make something different.
Right. That's right. Yeah. So it's going to be 500 horsepower. That's pretty good. And again, the remote rev feature on your key fob, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal car. And, you know, I encourage people to, you know, vote, if you will, with their pocketbooks. I think it's a much more powerful thing than voting at the ballot box. By snapping up cars like that, you're sending a signal to these car companies that that's what we want, as opposed to what the government is telling you you shall have.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I'm glad to see that, you know, and the reason is because, you know, I'm not in the market for a car. I know that's going to be an expensive car, 500 horsepower, the most horsepower they've ever had. And, you know, I would imagine it's going to be north of 60 grand, wouldn't you think?
Well, that's true. But, you know, there's still going to be the standard version of it. And that's no small fry either. They've managed to get, I think, 300 and something horsepower out of their 2.3-liter four-cylinder engine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you go back to the muscle car days, most of the V8s weren't making an honest 300 horsepower back in the day.
That's right. Yeah, it's a flagship thing. But I'm happy to see that they're doing it, not because I'm in the market for one, but because that means that the notion of private transportation and of actually being able to enjoy it instead of it being an appliance, that hasn't completely died. And I think that's a really positive thing.
Yeah, we've got to keep the lights on. You know, we may be at this point inevitably headed for a very dark period of time. But the key is to get through it and make it to the other side of it and then rebuild at the end of it. And one of the ways that we can do that is by showing support for and continuing to tout the benefits of sane alternatives to insanity.
That's right. And it's about keeping the culture going as well, you know, because we saw this with guns, right? Guns, it's not as ubiquitous as the automobiles are. So a lot of people don't really understand. They're afraid of it. It's easy to mischaracterize it in mainstream media. But, you know, when it's a part of the culture, when it's widely owned, then people understand. You have somebody, you know, nobody said when this last Christmas, when you had a guy use an SUV to kill people at a Christmas parade, mm-hmm. nobody suggested that we should ban cars or ban even SUVs or ban that particular kind of SUV. But they do that with guns. Because they don't understand the culture, but, you know, people don't make. So that's why it's important to keep the culture going. That's why it's important to have private ownership of transportation. But we still got to keep them from ripping up all the roads in the name of racism.
that's right. And, you know, speaking of widely understood, understanding is beginning to percolate upwards about the true nature of electric cars and electric car liabilities. A lot of people who bought in are buying out because they found out the truth, you know, after the purchase, and are pretty unhappy about the bill of goods that they got sold. And I think that the more EVs that get into circulation, the more people are going to realize these tremendous deficits, leaving aside the cost, And there's going to be a glut of these things on the market. People aren't going to want to buy them anymore once they realize everything that comes along for the ride.
Yeah, you have an article about that, what they aren't telling people about EVs. And you point out a lot of the downfalls. To me, it's about the centralized control. And what I've been concerned about is how the two were really sold together by Elon Musk. Look, we're going to have autonomous control. We're going to be pushing out updates and all this type of stuff. And it's like, well, that really concerns me. And we see as they move forward in the future, and they're talking about how they want to push everybody into cars that have to be attached to the grid in some way. They're saying, we're going to use your car as a battery to draw power back into the grid. We're going to start charging you more if you've got a car hooked up, even in your home. The prices are going to go up on the charging stations if we have the electricity, because as you and I both know, and as everybody is starting to see now through Europe and the U.S. and everything, they're shutting down all the inputs into the power grid. So it's that centralization that is what's concerning to me. And that's one of the reasons I think they're so exclusively focused on the battery option, because you can have other electric cars that are fuel cell or other things to have an electric vehicle, but the battery allows them to exert power through the control grid.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's why, and I'm working on an article about this right now, hybrids are suddenly in the crosshairs.
Yes.
And you'd think it would be the opposite, because, you know, you're talking about vehicles that are fundamentally a partially electric car, and their emissions are within fractions of whatever the so-called zero-emissions electric cars are, and may even be less, because they don't have these massive batteries, and they don't draw all of that electricity from these utility plants that burn hydrocarbon fuels to create the electricity. But the point is, you know, you can pick up something like a Honda Insight for about $24,000. It's not tethered to a cord. You have 500-plus miles of range. It's a very practical and key thing, a very affordable vehicle, meaning lots of people could get one if they wanted to. Now, if you really believe that the climate was in crisis and it was absolutely essential that people transition into these efficient types of cars, wouldn't you rather that, say, 1,000 people drove a hybrid rather than 100 people drove a Tesla?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you have, I said the same thing about when they were banning them in the UK and other places. They're saying, well, we're banning diesel, then we're banning gasoline, then we're banning hybrid cars. And it's like, whoa, that doesn't make any sense at all, because the hybrid is a way to get rid of range anxiety for people as well. It's another
range reality.
Yeah, exactly. So,
you know, it's not an irrational anxiety. It's a real problem.
Yeah, that's right. And so it really does show what their true agenda is. You know, it's absolute control of transportation, and that means they have to eliminate private transportation, and anything that remains will be for a few people who can afford something that is very expensive and easily controlled still from a central location. That has always been their goal. I remember years ago in Raleigh, I was at a meeting, city council, and they had a lady who had just returned from the Soviet Union. This is before the Soviet Union fell in 1989. And she was going on and on about how the little town of Raleigh needed to have some kind of rail system, because in Moscow, you could go anywhere you wanted to for a nickel. And I said, you have no idea what the true cost of that is.
Yep. Yeah. The cost true everything. Cost is everything. All everything. Your freedom. Yeah, everything.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Hey, by the way, speaking of Elon Musk, you know, I wrote an article about this the other day. Teslas have killed again. They killed two motorcyclists in somewhere out in, I think it was Southern California, ran right into them on the highway because the self-driving technology didn't see the motorcycles. And it speaks to Elon Musk's motives. You know, he has decided that not to use the cheapest possible method of developing his self-driving technology, which relies on cameras and his software programming of the cameras. LiDAR is far too expensive for Elon. And radar is problematic because radar can't distinguish between fixed objects and moving objects, and so the car will just break, and people don't like that. So instead he went with his cheap-out system, and then he tells people essentially, you know, oh, sure, it's self-driving. Get in the car, and it'll go wherever you want to go, including right over some poor motorcycle rider. Wow. And somehow he manages to get away with this. It's just astonishing to me.
It is, yeah. Even though they were investigating that at the time, they don't stop it. You know, how many times we've had, when I talk about the vaccines, I talk about this all the time. Just a couple of weeks ago, you had a particular motorized crib that would give kind of a erratic rocking movement to the babies. And you had one baby get caught up and strangled by that thing, right? And died. And another one was strangled but didn't die. So you have two babies that are injured by it. One of them dies, and they take all of them off the market. But they don't do that for anything else. They don't do it for the vaccines. Right. They don't do it for the Teslas. They don't do it for anything else. If it fits into their political agenda, they look the other way. If it doesn't, they're all about safety, right? Safety to the nth degree. But if it's part of their political agenda, safety is off the table.
Yeah, once again, I think that that speaks to their motives. You know, I think it's very, very important that people understand that these are not well-meant but incompetent people. They are deliberately malicious people who are pushing something on you under false pretenses.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk. This is an interesting story that I just saw, Eric. This is a guy who had a modified diesel truck in New Jersey. Did you see this story about him?
Oh, yeah. I know where you're going with this.
Yeah.
I know.
Yep. Isn't this amazing? Yep. Just to tell the audience what's going on with it, he put it on Facebook to sell it. So he's got a diesel truck. It's a 2008 Dodge Ram 2500. And he said that it was had the keyword is deleted, which means that they've deleted some of the emission control stuff or something. Yep. They messed with it, right, to make it run better. And he bought it that way. But you have some of these cops in New Jersey or whatever, bureaucrats, saw that. And they contacted him and they said, you're going to put that back to factory specs or you're going to crush it. And if you don't do that, we're going to arrest you and put you in jail.
Yeah.
Wow. And and he didn't. And so he's crushing it because he can't afford the $10,000 to restore this 2008 truck to its original factory condition as they demand. Where's the due process in all of this stuff?
Well, it isn't. The administrative state simply decrees, and we're supposed to obey and follow. And by the way, a lot of these administration apparatus are armed. The EPA now has armed agents, and so do a lot of these other entities that will go out, and I use the term hut you, for violating whatever the administrative state says you're supposed to obey.
That's right. Yeah, it's amazing to see how social media is being used for surveillance like this. I mean, we've already seen in the past people who are hunters, and they pose with their guns or whatever. Look, I got a new gun. And then the knock on the door, right? Mm-hmm. Or you get kicked out of school or something if you got a kid in the picture. But we've seen that on social media. This is on Facebook Marketplace, and they're going through and looking at what people are, how they're describing their vehicles to essentially destroy the vehicle and to confiscate the property without any due process. This is like civil asset forfeiture, and they've been getting away with this forever with the war on drugs. They say, oh, well, you know, your car must be destroyed. Even deregistered it. He said, well, I don't have it registered anymore. They said, that's not good enough. You're going to have to either prove to us that you restored this for $10,000, or you're going to prove to us that you crushed it.
Yeah, it's a kicking up of what used to be the case, which was, okay, if I sell a vehicle to you, then it's up to you to deal with registering and titling it. And in states that have some sort of emissions test requirement, you might have to go to the emissions place and get your thing tested, and then it's up to you to make the necessary repairs if you want to have it legally registered and titled. It's not the obligation of the seller. Now, what they've done is to kick this up and say that even if a vehicle is not registered, even if it's not being used on public roads, they're going to send out the goon squad on you if you try to sell it to anybody.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with Porsche. Right? The Volkswagen is going to split them off. They think they're going to make $9.4 billion. What do you think about that? I mean, they're going to try to put this out. They said, we're going to position it as a best of companies. It's going to be like Ferrari and Louis Vuitton, right? And that's really what it's going to be. It's going to be like an overpriced purse, right?
Well, Volkswagen probably needs money in the first place, I would think.
Yeah.
And that may be fundamentally what's driving this. As far as Porsche, you know, boy, it's a mixed bag because Porsche at one time was very much a brand for enthusiast people who like to drive. But like so many of those higher-end brands, it's become an exotic car now, and its prices are so high that it attracts a different kind of person. Most of their models don't even have manuals anymore, I don't think.
That's right.
They're automatics, just like the Corvettes and the Ferraris and so on. So they're attracting a different sort of buyer, and that buyer may be into electrification. I don't know whether Porsche is going to go ahead and embrace the proverbial tar baby and go EV too. I guess we're going to have to wait and see.
Well, they've been pushing that significantly. I mean, they've come out with a couple of different models that have pushed that. And as you said, they don't do stick shifts anymore. They've been doing the automatic transmissions, flipper transmissions that are faster. So, you know, they've gone down that road. Part of this agreement is that they're going to turn it back to the family that they had basically pushed out when Volkswagen had taken it over.
And that may be a good thing. You know, it may prove to be the case that some of these boutique manufacturers that are relatively small volume manufacturers can get around some of the worst of the administrative state and continue to produce desirable vehicles. The downside is that they're going to be so costly that only a relative handful of people are going to be able to afford them. I think Volkswagen, you know, is committing Harry Carey by committing to this whole electrification thing, because fundamentally, literally, Volkswagen means the people's car.
Yeah.
And the whole point of a Volkswagen is that people can afford to buy them. And, you know, now they're going to be building these cars with starting prices, 40, 50, that hippie van, the electric hippie van is like, I think, a $50,000 or $60,000 vehicle. Who do they think is going to be buying these things?
Well, I think it'd be some left-wing bureaucrats in the federal government going back to their days of college, probably. That's their market.
Sure, but you can't run a business on that. You know, ultimately,
right.
At the end of the day, you have to be able to move volume if you're a volume manufacturer, and that's what Volkswagen is. And, you know, the Volkswagen can't be a small niche brand by definition because it's not a prestige brand. You know, the last time they tried to do this was back in the late 90s when they came out with the Phaeton. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And it was a wonderful car, but it was also something at the time. It was like a $60,000 base price car. This is like back in the, you know, early 2000s, late 90s. I can't remember exactly. And people who buy that cars at that price point don't want to buy a Volkswagen. You know, they're going to get an Audi or a Lexus or a BMW or something like that. So I think Volkswagen has really painted itself into a corner here.
Well, you know, they've had a gun to their head. You and I have talked about it many, many times about this emission cheating scandal.
Yeah.
Nobody was injured. I mean, it wasn't like the exploding gas tanks in the Pinto. It wasn't like the exploding Takata airbags. Nobody was hurt with anything. But you cheated us, and so we're going to hit you for $4 billion. And you're talking about them selling Porsche for $9 billion. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's half of the value of that very valuable company that they expect to get that money out of, that they hit them for, you know, that thing. And so, you know, as you were pointing out, they had some great affordable diesels that were going to get 100 miles per gallon, and they got the emissions down. The rest is, no, we're going to kill it because we want to have one solution.
I think it's important that, you know, we talk about intentions and understanding what people's intentions are, and I think it's equally important that we begin to demand that when something is asserted as causing harm, that the fact be established before harms are imposed on people in the name of preventing this asserted hypothetical and probably not real harm. Whether it's fractional oxides of nitrogen emissions on a federal test for certifying diesel engines or a virus that doesn't kill 99.8% of healthy people, it's important that we do a cost-benefit analysis. I think that this is something that should be applied generally.
That's right. Yeah, years ago, before I even went to InfoWars, it was over a decade ago, you had the EPA in Research Triangle Park, where I was living, set things up to try to extend their regulations on emissions, especially on diesel engines. They looked for people who were sick, who had respiratory issues, who had heart issues as volunteers, and then they hooked them up directly to a tailpipe. And we had pictures of it. They took out the carbon monoxide, but they exposed them to that. And so if they could get them sick, they used that. They wanted to use that to up the regulations, except they were exposing them to levels that were 72 times higher than what they'd said were harmful. And the whole time that was going on, you had a dog and pony show with Lisa Jackson, who was head of the EPA, and Markey, who was a congressman at the time, talking about how fine particulate matter from diesel engines were killing more people than heart disease and cancer. Same stuff we saw with COVID. Just amazing how they run the same plan over and over again.
You know, and at the same time, they will not say anything about the hundreds of thousands of people who are killed every year as a result of medical malpractice and pharmaceutical drugs.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, you know, we're talking about Germany and Porsche. We got Bosch, the head of Bosch Electrical Subsystems. They're concerned about the singular focus on battery cells. I said, you know, hey, if you want to have electric cars, let's try some other things. That's a story that Breitbart has. I said, we're currently seeing the consequences of a gas shortage in Germany and Europe because we had too few alternatives. Now we're going to do the same thing in the automotive industry because we're going to push everybody into battery cells and we can't produce enough of them. And so they understand what's happening with this. It's amazing that everybody sees what the problem is, just like we see what the problem is with the pandemic nonsense and the vaccine toxicity. But nobody can do anything about this. It's like we're all powerless to stop these people who have seized our institutions, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think it's psychological. There's a sort of a shock that attends being assaulted by all of the things that we have been assaulted with over the past several years. And heck, I mean, all the way back to 9/11 and the war on terror and all of this. And I think it takes a while for people to recover their senses and step back and really begin to consider what's going on and to understand, for example, that the motives are not benign, that these people are evil, frankly, that their intentions are evil. And then it becomes a question of, my God, how do we deal with that? And I think that there's a lag in between the understanding and the taking of action.
Yeah, you have even people who have been vaccine skeptics, people who have been at the forefront of, focusing on the harmful effects of this, people like Alex Berenson, Eugypius, others like that, are saying, well, it's not a sinister plan, you know? And it's like, wow, you know, that is really disturbing that they don't see how this is a long-term plan and just how sinister it is. I've said for the longest time, we underestimate the moral depravity of these people, and we underestimate their technical capability as well.
That's right. There is a naivete here. You know, I've gotten into a number of debates with people regarding the Orange Man about this, and I'll say to them, you know, I'm more than willing to give the Orange Man a pass for the first few months, let's say, of 2020, because after all, a lot of us were caught off balance. We were hit with this stuff, and oh my God, what's happening? We don't really know. But there came a point shortly thereafter where we did know, and we began to have very sound evidentiary basis for believing that this is a scam. This is an organized psyop. It's intended to sow panic and fear for malignant objectives. I don't understand how people cannot see it now, particularly when we have, just to cite one thing, the overt fact that what was sold to us as a vaccine is nothing of the kind. It's admitted to now that people who took the vaccine are not immunized from getting this sickness. And that's a fact. It's not misinformation. It's not opinion. It is a fact. It is therefore reasonable to conclude that they were lying to us about a whole bunch of other things, including this mask-wearing business and a variety of other things. And I do think that that's beginning to percolate upward. And I think if we're allowed to have midterms, and if we're allowed to have honestly counted midterms, I think you're going to see a tsunami of repudiation of all of this.
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, I hope people are not going to, but I see it on the Republican side. They will focus very narrowly on Fauci, and they'll focus very narrowly on Wuhan. But even that, even if they talk about that, well, you know, let's not pay any attention to the vaccine. Let's talk about where we think this all came from. You know, we had a bioweapon that was released intentionally or accidentally or whatever. And even when they do that, they don't broaden it out to say, well, let's stop all gain of function research. They won't even do that. And they won't question the vaccine, and they won't question Trump's involvement with it. They'll only talk about Biden's involvement with it. It's so narrowly focused. It's a limited hangout. It's infuriating to watch how these people are handling it.
Well, it is, and it's the same kind of cognitive dissonance that afflicts people on the left, in that they're not able apparently to discern the fundamental principle and apply it, even if it makes them uncomfortable, even if it unsettles something that they thought was true beforehand. With regard to the Republican Party Incorporated, the GOP as an institution, I think it's going to be a continued fail until it begins to assert principles again and defend them. What they're doing right now is equivocating and being kind of Benthamite utilitarianism people, where, oh, this worked sort of well, rather than this is right, this is wrong.
Yeah,
we have to get back to that.
That's right. Yeah, it's just about their political gain, and that is tied to their political party. And so that's why the partisanship stuff was always routinely condemned by the founding fathers. They knew where this would lead us. You know, there was an interesting connection between the pandemic and the automotive industry, and that's the ventilator. And, you know, Eric, there's an article that just came out from Children's Health Defense about the ventilator frenzy. And they went back, you know, Jared has published his memoirs, right? And in his memoirs, they actually read that. So hats off to whoever sat down and actually opened up Jared Kushner's memoirs. I can't imagine anything that would be more heinous to have to do. But they did it, and they found some very interesting stuff there. Let me play a short clip to remind people what was going on with the ventilator and with the Trump administration and with automobile companies like Ford and GM.
We are working to sign contracts immediately with the major ventilator companies in the country, including GE, Philips, Medtronic, Hamilton, Zoll, RedMed, Hillrom, and Vyaire. These are all companies that do this, great companies. The FDA will be reducing and waiving unnecessary regulations in order to get this.
Yeah, waive the regulations.
Getting rid of certain.
Isn't it great? Let's see. And God knows how many people were killed by those ventilators.
That's right. That's the point they're making here. But here it goes to the Ford factory here. Look at this. Mm-hmm.
The call to serve. You're building a great medical arsenal to defeat the virus.
Yeah.
Cement America's place as the leading manufacturer and exporter of ventilators anywhere in the world. With your help and our policies, this country is poised for an epic comeback. The Ford name will forever stand as a symbol of American excellence and innovation.
Yeah, there you go. So the epic music, that video there at the end is produced by the White House, and you hear the heroic music coming in. The heroic people who've come back to Ford, they stopped making cars because who needs them? What we need are ventilators that kill 30 to 80% of the people. And actually, I've heard that be much higher. I talked to a pandemic nurse who wrote a book about it, and she put it north of 90% of the people there in New York where they were putting them on that. And that's the thing that's really heinous about this. Shutting down productive industry, taking it over, centrally planning something that nobody needs. It's a hallmark of communism, isn't it? And then things that kill people.
Yep, exactly. Things that kill people. You know, we're no longer talking about, oh, it's an obnoxious tax, we're going to have to hand over more money to the government. Now we're handing over our lives and our health to these people.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and then this article from Children's Health Defense, they talked about the fact that Jared brags about two of his mega-rich friends who come in, and they're brought in. None of them have a clue about any of the medical issues. I've seen articles from people who specialize in respiratory illness, and doctors said, what's this about ventilators? We've never done this before. We've never done this for people on flu and things like that. And so they're looking at this askance, but his focus on it, he just saw it as, you know, somebody said something about ventilators. Well, let's mass produce these things.
Sure.
You know, and that was their focus. How are we going to get these things out and shut everything else down? And remember how Trump berated the CEO of GM because she didn't produce enough of them?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, one aspect of this is it's just about crony capitalism. You remember back after 9/11 when airports were forced to buy Michael Chertoff's naked scanners?
That's right. That's right. Which had already been
made
prepared.
A lot of money.
They'd already been prepared even before they had the underwear bomber. They were already, they'd designed them, manufactured them, had them sitting in the warehouse ready to go. And I talked many times to the lawyer, Haskell, who saw the guy being put on the plane. He was like this, you know, out of it, you know, drug addict, street guy, and a guy in a suit putting him on the plane. So he was watching him, and he wanted to testify, but they refused to let him testify. His defense lawyer used Haskell as a bargaining chip, but they didn't let him talk about what he had seen. The whole thing was a setup.
Yep. You know, the parallel example, you bring up communism, and if you look at the Chernobyl disaster, similar kind of a thing, you know, slipshod, incompetent, top-down orders about how to do something by people who have no business making orders about any such thing, and the result is a disaster.
Yeah, that's right. You got another article on a different topic, and that is just our out-of-control government and police, the crime of aimlessly walking around. Tell people what that was about.
Yeah, I do these episodic things when I find a news story about some truly outrageous act perpetrated by, as I style them, armed government workers. That's my term for cops, because I think that's accurate. I think that's what they are. And the one I'm talking about here, a couple of young guys apparently flipped a birdie to a passing cop, which isn't illegal, but it definitely affronted the authority of this armed government worker who wheeled around and gave them the third degree and accused them of aimlessly walking around. And on the basis of aimlessly walking around, applied handcuffs and, you know, did the degrading pat-down, demanded to have their IDs, where are they going, and all these other things. And the striking thing to me isn't so much the fragile ego and the immaturity of the armed government worker. It's the fact that this guy's supposed to be a law enforcement officer, right? That's the term they like to use. And yet you find that oftentimes these people are among the most ignorant of the law, and then make up law on the spot and enforce it. And there are no appreciable consequences for that. I mean, if you or I walked up to somebody on the street and said, hey, you're aimlessly walking around, show me your ID, you know, and then with a gun on our hip said, you better turn around, I'm going to put handcuffs on you and pat you down for my safety.
Yeah.
You'd find yourself in a prison cell. You'd certainly have had your right to carry a gun taken away from you. And yet you have no legal authority to do those things, whereas a law enforcement officer does. And it just constantly amazes me that they do this. And it's a regular thing. If you follow this stuff, it happens all the time.
Well, you know, I remember in years ago in New York, before they got preoccupied with all this pandemic stuff and everything, they were issuing people tickets for loitering all the time. That was one of their favorite things to do. And I remember some guys who had a barber shop, and it was illegal for them to smoke in their own barber shop. So they went out in front of their barber shop to smoke a cigarette. Then they got a ticket for loitering in front of their own barber shop so they could smoke a cigarette. It's like, where does this stuff end? It's absolutely insane. And there was a guy that his name was Adrian Schoolcraft. And he was kind of like a Frank Serpico character. His father was a cop. He was a cop. He wanted to be a cop on the beat. He wanted to know people. You know, he was kind of pushing back against this stuff. They were telling him, go out and write tickets, arrest people on Halloween. Just bring them in. We'll find out what we'll charge them with later. Just grab people and we'll charge them, figure out what the charges are later. We got to get the head count up here. And he rebelled against all that stuff. He eventually wound up putting a mic on and exposing a lot of corruption in the police department. But that was what he was pushing back against, was that, that whole attitude of, you know, let's just grab the citizens and we'll figure out what we're going to charge them with.
Yeah. You know, people talk about defunding the police. I'd rather that the police simply did an appropriate job. If we've got to have police, and that's a separate discussion, minimally, I think they should understand and know the law at a threshold level that's above the level of an ordinary person who isn't law enforcement.
Yeah.
They should be screened for temperament, for anger management, the ability to not go ballistic because somebody said something they don't like. And most of all, held accountable when they transgress the law. I don't think that's unreasonable. You know, you and I get held accountable if we violate the law. Why shouldn't they, at the very least? And I think there's a powerful argument to be made that they should be held more accountable because of the fact that they do have a gun and a badge, and it's their job to know the law.
That's right. Well, we have a very different approach in this country for training law enforcement than they do in other countries. I remember the story a few years ago. There were some, I think they were Swedish cops or some Scandinavian country. They were vacationing in New York, and they were on the subway, and something happened on the subway. Somebody started attacking somebody else. And these guys, unarmed, they just took the guy down because they were physically fit, and they knew how to defend themselves in martial arts and that type of thing. They basically tied the guy up in knots and sat on him until the real police got, the local police got there and arrested him. They didn't need to have weapons, but we hire people typically who are out of shape. We don't train them. If we do train them, we train them to shoot first. And that's really the only thing they've got, is to shoot somebody with a taser or to shoot somebody with a gun, because they're not trained and they're not fit to do the other work. And that's really the issue, along with the fact that I think, you know, when you look at the police departments, they're so focused on policy and on tickets and on revenue, and they're really not focused on being peace officers, you know, not at all.
And I think that other factor here, too, is that there's been a deliberate effort to inculcate a sense of paranoia in the cops.
Yes.
This whole idea that their job is so frighteningly, horribly dangerous, and then armoring them up like, you know, Batman with utility belts and multiple mags. You know, you dress up like that, and you tend to want to play that role, don't you?
That's right. Well, I've seen that, you know, the good police that are out there, and originally, you know, having police that are under the control of a city manager or a mayor or something like that to enforce policy and to make revenue, that really wasn't the original model. The original model in the U.S. was the sheriff. And the sheriff would be there, and he would have some deputies, and they would be kind of the core. And the real power was the power of the community. And it was really the same thing that we had in terms of not having a standing army. We would rely on a citizen militia. There would be an officer corps that was there, and they would be there to train people when a war came or something like that. But you know, you had a core of people, but not a standing army. And what we wind up with this model of the police that they forced on us, is something that is coming at us instead of joining with the community to defend each other. This is a policy enforcement arm with weapons. That's why an armed government worker really does describe how these police departments are.
Yes, it's another bureaucracy endowed with motives that are at odds with the community. And you can see this manifested in things like them calling us civilians, you know, which implies that what are they?
Yeah, an army. Yeah, they're an army of people. I saw this story, and what it made me think of was a time when I was working for Texas Instruments right after I graduated. And I was working really late one night, and there was nobody else on the road, and I'm coming up to the stop sign, and it turns yellow, and I almost go through it, and I see over on the right-hand side, I see a cop sitting there. And we're the only people on the road, and so it's like I really, you know, pulled it down, didn't screech my tires or anything, but I was able to pull it down. And he was looking straight at me, and I looked at him, and I smiled. And that was a big mistake. Because I left, that was a wee hours of the morning, and so I had to be back at 8 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, he was still on duty when I came back, and he was looking out for me. And he pulled me over and gave me a ticket because he said I'd changed lanes without using a turn signal. I mean, talk about contriving a charge. And they made me, I didn't know about the, you know, fighting it in a with a jury trial, because that's your ultimate weapon against that kind of stuff. But they made me, in order to not have a moving violation on my insurance, I had to take a class and all this other kind of stuff. And I didn't know any better at that time. So they got all, he got even with me for looking at him and smiling and saying, you thought you got me. Well, he got me the next day, didn't he?
Yeah, you know, and we laugh about it. But really, if you think about it, it's alarming, because what sort of a person behaves that way? You know, and has the authority of the state behind them, you know, has the gun and the badge. It's kind of scary when you think about a person with that kind of a prickly ego, who's a bully, and what he can do to you. And, you know, you're stuck in the position of essentially being legally prohibited from defending yourself against that sort of thing.
That's right. That's right. You got an article about the Libertarian Party. Tell us what's going on with the Libertarian Party.
Well, I'm not sure what's going on with the Libertarian Party per se. You know, I don't consider, well, let me back up. I think that libertarianism is fundamentally a moral philosophy, a code of ethics and values, and it's almost oxymoronic to speak of it as a party, because libertarians, small I, people like you and I, individuals, we don't seek power over anybody. We don't want to be in office, but we do live in a political world, and I think some members of the Libertarian Party make the mistake of refusing to accept anything less than the perfect, even if it means avoiding the worst. Now, this is just my own opinion. I've had a pretty vigorous debate on my site with people who disagree with me, but I think we have to be involved at some level and attempt to propagate ideas. I think Ron Paul is an excellent example of that. He's a principled libertarian, but he also ran for office and held office, and I think by doing so, he helped to get libertarian ideas out to a much broader audience. You and I can remember, when you said libertarian, if you said libertarian in, say, 1978, people have been, what are you talking about? What is that?
Oh, yeah.
Those kooks, you mean?
Oh,
like
yeah.
The Birchers, what's a libertarian?
You know, I would even now, put that into the early 90s, you know, when I was doing it. Nobody knew what a libertarian was, you know.
So we owe Ron Paul and people like him, you know, good, honest libertarian people who are willing to put themselves out there and to articulate and defend the ideas. You know, vote for me and I won't do anything to you. I think that's a capital slogan.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. You know, and I kind of look at it as, you know, there's this, what I see happening in the Libertarian Party was they started heading more towards a leftward orientation with Gary Johnson and stuff like that. And they kind of sold out to people like William Weld and Gary Johnson, because they wanted the legitimacy, you know, and so they started doing things like removing the principles of the non-aggression pact and things like that. And so now they've had people who said, no, we got to get back to fundamental principles. We got to, you know, keep liberty there at the front and limited government. And so there's a bunch of people really kind of coming from the Mises Foundation type of orientation who came back in. And now that's really these other people who were pushing a more leftist, politically correct woke agenda, as well as wanting to have credentials in there. That's really kind of created a schism within the party and a lot of pushback, a lot of debate.
Well, and that's all, you know, that's all healthy, I suppose. The debate is good. I think the thing that I would harp on is that there isn't a dichotomy in my mind between advocating for principles and at the same time doing whatever is possible. You know, I'd rather that the Titanic be kept afloat longer than let it sink, so that more people can get off of it. I'm all for keeping the pumps running as long as possible. You know, the more time we buy, I think the better the chances that the worst won't happen. And I think that that's a good thing. And I don't see how that contravenes taking a principled stand on things like the non-aggression principle.
I agree. You know, the one thing I noticed and even talked about it the whole time I was involved with the Libertarian Party was that the focus on the presidency. And part of that was because of ballot access laws. You know, they would typically come in and you would have to do extra things to get on the ballot. And then your ballot retention would be based on your vote totals for either president or governor, typically in most states. And so that caused an unhealthy focus on these higher offices. And I said, this is exactly the opposite of what we need to be doing, but they've put these regulations in place so that we only focus on the highest offices and we don't focus on the local offices where if you got to know the people in your community and you said, I want to defend your liberty against these pandemic things or stuff like that, that would be a real win. But you're not going to win at the state level. You're not going to win at the presidential level. But I still see this when people, when I criticize Trump, people say, well, who do you want as president? And it's like, focus on your sheriff, you know, focus on the local offices there. And that has been, and I can see that because I saw that that was the plan to keep us away from those local offices. That was what all the ballot retention laws and all the rest of the stuff was about. And that has been, you know, that was done to the Libertarian Party for so long. I think it became an unhealthy focus for them. To try to get people like Gary Johnson and stuff who really didn't really care too much about the principles, but they wanted to get more visibility and try to keep ballot access. So, you know, I think the real key is that people have to focus on local and they have to focus on liberty. And that ought to be really easy to do now after a couple of years of this medical martial law.
No question. You know, it's bottom up rather than top down. And I think we can take a cue from the left that does understand that.
That's right.
And, you know, and took many decades to worm its way into higher echelons of power by starting at the local level. You don't turn the Titanic around on a dime.
That's
right. It's going to take time to change things. And we're much more effective, I think, if we operate at the local level and be involved with the sheriff, the board of supervisors, the people running the school board, all of those sorts of things, rather than worrying about you know, which clown they're running for president.
That's right. Yeah, and for the longest time, the Democrats have said all politics is local, and they're right. And they also said, think globally, act locally. They wanted people on board with that global agenda. So I think from our standpoint, we need to understand globalism, but we need to block it locally. And I think that really is the approach.
It's psychologically empowering as well as politically empowering. I think many of us, certainly myself, you feel kind of impotent when you go there and you vote for whoever the president is, you know, Tweedledee or Tweedledum. You know, is your vote matter out of 80 million votes? What's the relevance? But when you are involved in your local community and you've actually met with, say, your local sheriff, and, you know, you are an active participant in seeing something change for the better, that makes you feel stronger rather than weaker. And I think people can take heart from that sort of thing, and doing more of it is going to be very beneficial for everybody.
I absolutely agree. Well, Eric, it's always great talking to you. EP Autos, folks, if you want to find somebody who understands some of the core issues in transportation, freedom in transportation, and he's got great car reviews, practical car reviews. I mean, I'm going to, you know, he doesn't do the cars that cost $3 million or whatever. That's what the other people, the other trade publications are all focused on these hyper cars and the hype about electric cars and everything. But Eric will give you the straight shot about liberty and transportation. I always enjoy going to your site and reading the articles that are there. Thank you so much for joining us, Eric.
Thank you always, David. I really appreciate your having me.
Appreciate it. Thanks. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.
Decoding the mainstream propaganda. It's the David Knight Show.
Let's talk a little bit about talk about having a second church committee hearing. And people are starting to look at the surveillance and how rampant this has become. Facebook, of course, spying on private messages of people and then sending these things to the FBI and saying, you know, hey, don't you want to give us a search warrant so we can rat out these people to you. I mean, that's what this has become. We already have, the McCarthyism is already embedded in Facebook. And when you look at how it has been used, as I was talking about earlier, this situation where They forced the guy to crush his truck because they're scanning the data. Facebook was just the implementation of their total information awareness program that everybody said, well, we don't want to have anything like this. So they shut it down and they made it private and called it Facebook. Same day that they shut down the total information awareness program of Homeland Security, they started this thing up. And so now calls are growing to have a new church committee hearing. And I'll just say, I fully expect it to be as useless as the first one. Now, what came out of the first church committee hearing? I've talked about this many times. There was also a committee hearing that you never hear talked about, the Pike committee hearing in the Congress. And the reason why you don't hear that is because while they're having the church committee hearing in the Senate, you don't hear them talking about the Pike committee hearing because that was focused on the NSA. And the church committee hearing was focused on the CIA. And at the time, we had to pretend that the NSA didn't even exist. At that time, and even after that, people would joke that NSA stood for no such agency, created by an executive order by Harry Truman. And when the Pike committee hearing called in the head of the NSA to testify, they said, we'd like to see your charter, because I'm not going to show it to you. That's how open to oversight the deep. And so when we go back and look at the church committee hearing, as well, set all that stuff up. Did that stop these people from spying on us? No. They just went to the FISA court and actually facilitated it. They took this around and they facilitated their surveillance by saying, we can go there and we can get a search warrant for, as Rand Paul pointed out, Mr. and Mrs. Verizon. And that's wrong. And so they were able to use the FISA court to surveil everybody, get kind of a blanket general warrant, which the whole purpose of the Bill of Rights prohibitions against that were because they'd seen general warrants had been used against people by the Crown, and they didn't want to have that type of thing again. So it became a tool. Something that was supposed to keep them in line became a tool. It's like they took the handcuffs off and started beating us with the handcuffs we put on them. And that's really what happened with the FISA court. Of course, there was also, as it was going on, the public perception was very different. The public perception was all about the assassination attempts that the CIA had done and the heart attack gun and all the sensational things like that were used to keep people from really looking at what was happening. It was a PR exercise. But now people are calling for another one. I think, frankly, it would be great for the FBI, said Kevin Brock, the Bureau's first ever intelligence chief, said of the notion of a new church committee. You notice that? The first ever intelligence chief? This is the mission creep of these creeps in the FBI. You know, they now have an intelligence chief. They find themselves in a place right now where well over a half a century, half the country, believes that they're working on behalf of one political party or another, he said. So you know how this is going to be used. This is going to be used as a big PR gimmick to tell people, well, first of all, that's not really happening. But secondly, we're going to put in some restrictions that are going to make sure that that doesn't happen again. Because when they had the church committee hearings, they already knew that the NSA and the CIA were spying on Americans without warrants, listening to their phones without warrants, and had been from their creation. And so they put that piece in there to stop them, but they just continued to do it and did it even more. They said, we need to have something like the 9/11 Commission. Oh, well, that should do the job, right? That was so effective. Former House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes, who helped to unravel the false Russia collusion narrative, said the reality is that what they really need is a blue ribbon commission, or they need to select a committee to would be a better, or select committee would be a better option to investigate than to using Congress. He said, you know, we really weren't designed to run these types of investigations. For so long, the process actually worked. It was relatively bipartisan. But when you have corruption at this level, it becomes hard to run these investigations correctly. Well, that's exactly right. You go back and look at the original church committee hearing. They had people like Walter Mondale, Howard Baker, Barry Goldwater, John Tower, Gary Hart, all these people. Many of them had run or would run for president. But the whole thing was a limited hangout. It was grandstanding for the people that were there. It was misdirection into ancillary issues. And it wound up with some legislation that was a fig leaf. I don't think they'll even come up with any regulation at this point. I mean, that's how corrupt Congress is at this point. Before I run out of time, I want to thank some of the people who have left tips on Rockfin. Thank you, Andromeda One, and Lewis Tart. Thank you again. And Faded Reality, thank you very much. And Mark M228, he says, let's push it over 100. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. And it looks like it did. Guard Goldsmith, thank you for the tip, Guard. I appreciate that. He says, thanks for such great information, David. It's fantastic to hear Eric. And thanks to you, my investment in precious metals has increased via Wise Wolf and Tony. Well, thank you. That's the good. And that's the thing. I want to get more people on from a prepping and from an agricultural standpoint, but from a financial standpoint, I mean, there's not really anything that I know of that's any better to do than to try to have money that is outside the system, something that is valuable, that's not somebody else's debt, that you have control over. But we've got to do that with our food. We've got to do that in a lot of different ways. We have to focus locally on what is going to happen. And we have to understand that this whole system, you know, when we look at Facebook, this is not something that evolved this way. As I said many times, I believe this thing was a plan. You had the CIA actually going public and not even trying to hide the fact that they'd set up a venture capital firm. And these are the firms that were picking the competitors. They didn't pick the winners and the losers. They let these people compete against each other because it was even better if one of the many horses that they had financially backed, they let these horses then fight it out amongst themselves. And then the strongest one would win, but it would still be one of their guys that's going to cooperate with them. I think, you know, when I look at the church hearing, I always think about John Rizzo. He was a lawyer for the CIA. And he said the reason he decided he'd become a lawyer and go to work for the CIA was because of the church committee hearings. He said, I looked at that, and he wasn't repulsed by what the CIA was doing. He looked at it and he said, you know, they need a better lawyer. And they don't have very good lawyers. I could really do well there. And he did. And he was the guy, he wrote a book called Company Man. And he was the guy who came up with the euphemism for terror, torture, enhanced interrogation. That was his thing. And he defended the FBI even over their torture thing. It's kind of like the line from Breaking Bad, where Saul Goodman, referring to Saul Goodman, the one character says to the other, he says, you need a criminal lawyer. And he goes, yeah, I guess. You need a criminal lawyer, a lawyer who is going to do anything to get around these laws. And that's exactly what we have in front of us now in terms of these people. So I, just like a constitutional convention, I don't really trust them to get anything done with this. Only good news is that we've had a court uphold Texas's anti-censorship social media law. And now this is going to go to the Supreme Court. They have said that critics of the law argue you can't tell corporations not to censor people. That violates their free speech. So corporations are people, as Mitt Romney said. And you better not step on their free speech. They can step on your free speech. Well, the whole point of Section 230 is that they are not to regulate speech. They're just a public square, but none of that stuff matters. That's where we need to understand where these people are. But we're out of time. Thanks for joining us. The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com.